Hello and welcome to Scoppy Radio. My name is Daniel Johansson.
And I'm Maureen Smith, and today we are joined by co-founder of the Prop Theater, Stefan Brun.
Hi, nice to be here today.
Yeah.
It's great to have you.
Thanks.
Yeah, it's definitely one of those things where, like, the Prop Theater is such an institution. It's really cool to be able to sit with you and talk. And we've already kind of, like, we always do this thing. I always mention on the show where we've kind of talked a bit before the recording. And we're just like, because I didn't realize that, I mean, because one of the things that that people of the show probably know is Maureen and I's like experience with opera and kind of European art in that by extension.
Right. You just
and,
told me.
Your being from Europe specifically is so cool. I mean, that sounds so cliche of me to say, but
it's so cool that you're from Europe.
Yeah.
Well, it made a real difference though, and because not only opera but theater at all is just more prevalent and more financially supported, and I had the privilege in my life of working in both places. I'm not only from Europe, but after I founded the Prop Theater with Scott V. Hill in 1981, I was able to go over and work in Bonn and Frankfurt and Berlin for 15 years in the German theater and in German television, so I got to get a taste of both worlds.
Yeah.
No, I studied abroad in Germany when I was in high school, and I was fortunate enough to be able to go to a play there in, I think it was either in Fulda or in Frankfurt, but we saw like this 4-hour long adaptation of Faust, like the play Faust, not the opera. Right. And it was in this beautiful outdoor theater, and it was very experimental, and I, as a 17-year-old, did not appreciate it. But, right. Like, looking back on it, I'm like, wow, like, there is no way that, you know, that type of infrastructure would just be, like, in some small town somewhere. Like, right. It was gorgeous. And so, yeah, like, you speaking to having, like, the privilege of being able to benefit from that amazing, just like embedded culture is absolutely incredible.
It allows for experiment. It allows for a long range. There's just as much there now as here at a broad youth movement that wants a pop culture thing. But there's also a place where the new is incubated, where you don't have to like it yet, and where you can try things and experiment. And that's the through line for me.
Well, I want to provide some more context, because we could definitely just jump into any of these iterations of philosophical conversation. But I think that there's also a degree to which I'm sure that there are a lot of people that are listening that are familiar with the Prop Theater, but I also think that there are some that are not. So would you mind kind of explaining what the Prop Theater is?
Absolutely.
And the mission of it?
As you started, you said a long on institution like the Prop Theater, and that really amused me, because the whole point of the Prop Theater, and I think that which makes us arguably the oldest storefront theater in Chicago, founded in 1981, is our absolute resistance to institutionalization. We, I like to say, have always been, and there's lots of things we haven't always been, but we've always been more about the project or projects that we are doing right now, and define ourselves, our identity, our form, our administration around that, than any long-term ideals or doctrines or techniques or fathers or mothers. So I think that's the main thing about the Prop Theater. It survives because it changes.
Mm-hmm. I'm really interested in, like, kind of contextualizing the founding of it, because you mentioned the year you were born before we started recording.
1959,
which puts you at being 22 or 21 when the Prop Theater was founded. I'm curious, like, what at that point in your life led you to the founding of a theater company?
That's a wonderful question, and I thank you for it, because in all the time we've been talking about this, that so rarely comes up. We were young. We were, Scott V. Hill and I, students at Columbia College. At the time, the Columbia College Theater Department was pre-Sheldon Patinkin, who was a huge leader of the theater department. The theater is now named after him. And he was just coming in as we were passing out. We had worked together to form a experimental theater in the 11th Street, in the theater department there, which hadn't had a studio or experimental theater before then. I came out of a tradition of Brecht. My grandfather was an actor in expressionist German theater, in the Hollywood exile community, and a director in post post-war German theater, who had been an associate of Brecht's, had been in some of Brecht's first Berlin productions in the 20s. And I grew up, my mother was an assistant director for Brecht at some point, so I grew up out of that tradition. And what I only found out later, the Compass Players, who arguably founded the community, the off-loop theater movement in Chicago, also opened with a Brecht production when they first began. And I think there's a connection between what started them, what started us, which was a wish to counter theater, the velvet ropes, the hidden, we're going to put something behind a curtain and we have secrets and illusions. And we had completely different ideas of theater, more of a forum, more of a place where those of us who like music and movies better would be able, without a big budget, to create new and experimental work.
I'm going to jump into a deep end. I think the a thing that's really interesting about your background and the moment that Chicago underground art and theater finds itself in is it does seem to be getting more attention. And it would be the question that first came to mind for me is like, oh, do you think we're in a underground resurgence? But then the realization that the underground art has always been in Chicago came to me. And then so what I'm curious for you is do you feel that like work like what the Prop Theater is doing is finding more attention in that moment, in this moment? And what do you think about that?
No, thank you. You know, there's the progressive paradigm, the idea that we are always moving forward towards either an apocalypse or the great wonderful thing, is something I counter in almost all of my thinking. What I do think is I think there are waves. Uh-oh, and I think I should not come to a podcast and have a telephone on.
Okay.
That's no good.
I always love phone calls during interviews because it's like, then you know how important the person is.
Well, what I have done is change that ringtone. That's a ridiculous, but I noticed that ringtones start to make me anxious, and so I changed the ringtone. But I'm going to go back to my comment about progress. I don't think that we're moving towards, no, I don't think there's more underground work. I do think it comes in waves and that the politics and the wider cultural spectrum creates times, not to speak of the economic spectrum, creates times when there is more work being done independently of institutions, and then there's times where the institutions or the city is picking up more work. When we started, it was the Reagan era, and there was nothing. They were just cutting off the NEA. Every Q told us, hey, go do what you can because you ain't getting nothing. Mm-hmm. Then came Harold Washington, one of the most exciting moments in my entire political life here in Chicago, and all of a sudden, movies could be made in Chicago again. You could get a license and make music on the streets in Chicago, which you could not do before then. All of a sudden, it was a resurgence of work in Chicago. Likewise, before us, when J. Pat Miller did the Artaud Project, or when there was the Hull House and June Pekosik doing the first feminist theater in Hull House, there was work where I got to be the lighting guy as a college student. There are always moments when it was really coming, and then moments where you're like, it's diet.
Where do you think we're at now?
I actually, as a guy renting a venue, which is one of the things I do, I've got kind of a finger on the pulse. What I think right now is there are a whole lot less theater companies saying, we're going to do a repertoire and we're going to do 5-6 week runs of shows where we want to apply for a Jeff Award, whoever that is. Yeah. And instead, there are people saying, there is so much we can make as work. Yeah. There is so much permission right now to open up and do storytelling or do dance performance art or do multidisciplinary work that mixes and is emerging storytelling. And people are interested in exploring the new, and there's a lot of that. Mm-hmm. But there are less people forming ensembles and little groups and renting for 5-6 week runs.
And let me actually ask a question. Do you feel like the audience palette is changing with, like, do you think that people are more willing to go for abstract or surreal or kind of what is not maybe narrative driven or?
Oh, yes, absolutely. And that's probably the biggest change in the time that I've been working here. At the time when, well, I don't know, even 15, 20 years ago, Trapdoor, Tuta, a couple of theater companies were doing work like that. And now there's just a far wider range of work like that. And I remember a couple of years in one of those more standard League of Chicago Theater meetings where an announcement was made that audiences were shrinking. And I had been reading the statistics at the time and was able to counter that and say, no, as a matter of fact, that just is not true. What was shrinking was subscription audiences. Mm-hmm. And subscription audiences are markedly shrinking, and perhaps audiences for standard conventional plays are. I don't know that number, mm-hmm. but I think audiences are growing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it's wild because we go to a fair number of like experimental shows, and you know, it's, you'd be hard pressed to find us at Steppenwolf and Goodman and stuff like that. But like, it's always wild to me, you know, people talk about the decline of theater, but like, I can't tell you how many like sold out performances we've like stood in the back of, and like, mm-hmm. just it's so heartening and also so frustrating to see such strong attendance at these more underground shows, but then like institutional Chicago theater ignoring that and touting the decline of the yeah. theater going audience.
I agree with you. I'm an optimist. Probably wouldn't do this kind of work if I wasn't an optimist. So in the context of your previous question, what I would say is in that wave of times, we just are coming out of a time where lots of independent people for very little in incubator places like the Prop Theater mm-hmm. originated different approaches to work. And now the institutions are catching up a little bit. Mm-hmm. And there is a place to go as a young person now seeking a real union contract and a livable wage. There's not enough. And there isn't, then there won't be for some time. Mm-hmm. But I do see Goodman for a longer time. Steppenwolf now also, perhaps. Other places in Chicago with slightly more institutional heft, with slightly more budget, making space for this kind of new work. They have to.
And that's great.
Well, and I wanna touch more on this. The thing that I find, like at a structural level, very important is the willingness to not just be open to experimentation, but to build and structures that involve experimentation, and to allocate resources to experimentation, and to hire experimentally. Like, that is some, and you know, I'm basically, we've had Olivia Lilly on the show like six times, and like, we obviously know, I would be hard pressed to not bring her up and mention that, like, it's one of those things where, you know, basically what I'm curious for you is like that willingness to hire from people that are, because Olivia Lilly, I wouldn't say that she's like new, like she's obviously been working for a while, but not in an institutional sense.
Exactly.
You know what I mean?
Oh, exactly.
Yeah.
How I met Olivia Lilly was that she was making work. Mm-hmm. She was making work where I was going, gosh, this is the kind of work that I've been with both in Germany and here. She was working on a full production of Faust, a central mm-hmm. German text. And one that I care about a whole lot, as much because of how in Germany it's used to lull people to sleep, like Shakespeare is in England, mm-hmm. as for how it's also a vibrant text that I've seen used to make really exciting theater that is classic in the best sense, which is that it can be made to live in any time. And I met Olivia and I was like, who are you? You want to make Faust, this thing I really know a whole bunch about in my manly way, and you're going to make it in people's living rooms where you're going to a different living room each time. You've got this really super young ensemble. This is like, they're never going to even have time to read it all. You'll never work. You know, I had doubt after doubt and skeptic, but I noticed immediately when speaking with her that she certainly was not laughing off my interest in it or my skepticism, and she invited me to come, and it was a turning point in my being here in Chicago. There's a couple of them. Max Truex, who does Brecht here in Chicago, is another one, where as an older guy, a guy who worked here and then left to be able to be paid more and pursue more experimental theater and then came back, to see young people, Olivia's half my age, Max somewhere in there also, doing work that really renews things that I once started and shows me things that I don't know yet and that refresh. There were people in that Faust performance who not only did they get the story, not only did it not only work in living rooms, but it made it better and less boring. And I walked around not bored for a second following it, but each actor had a monologue about why they were doing Faust right now that they had written also as part of it, and it wasn't too long.
I have a really, I feel like we could talk. The thing that I really want to ask about, and this is like so personal, so excuse me for being a little selfish, but one of the things that I always think is that I've always thought about, because for a while I was producing opera with Opera on Tap Chicago, which is like, and so I always like. My first introduction to the prop theater was your work with Third Eye. And I always loved that conceptually in what is being produced in Chicago operatically. And I would say that, because this was before Scoppy, this was before a lot of things. And so to have that kind of introduction to what prop theater's palette is an interesting outlook. And so I'm curious, and I'm sure that there are people that are also opera people, like when it comes to being a theater that is not a traditionally operatic theater, what do you look for when you produce that genre, or you know what I mean?
So it's so wonderful to ask, and Reen Ahmed, who brought the Third Eye to us, really was looking to put opera in a different context, that it was intentional to come to the prop theater, and we really had a good association. We also have the Curious Theater branch, which is in residence of the Prop Theater, our co-producer of the Rhinoceros Theater Festival. And there are two composers working on operatic-like constructions. Now over years, one of them at Prop Theater, Matt Test, who is a composer really of interest. He's composing what I would call opera buffos, where the first one was, I would say, very much on the experimental side. And recently, he's really finding a form where the value of it is quite high. And there's going to be an 8-channel festival at Prop Theater coming up in June, where indeed one of his little operas are going to be performed, and also not an opera, but Jenny Magnus, who is one of the artistic directors of the Curious Theater branch, is composing a play entirely sung called Open Wide that also is going to be at that 8-channel festival in June. So what we look for is on the compositional or devising side, both true experimentation, true looking to enlarge the form, and mixing of different medias that require live presence in the room.
This is why I wanted to come into this train of thought, because when I'm hearing you talk about, because obviously we know Faust, you know, like, and we know, like, the thought of having that European art mindset is that you do have that appreciation for the, we talk about this a lot, this idea of appreciating the traditional, but also knowing that there needs to be a way to experiment. And I think opera is actually a really interesting subcategory for that conversation, because like that, because the same way, like how you were talking about Faust, like, yeah, you know, Puccini is a good example where like I could see a Bohème and it's like every other Bohème I've ever seen. But then there's also a way that could be done experimentally, and that it's such an interesting, like, I don't entirely know yet how to put into words that thing, but I'm kind of curious about maybe revisiting, like, what about when you saw that Faust made it feel like the experimental work that you knew from your hands-on experience with live work?
It is the thing that I would take back to what I learned from Brecht, and Brecht, my favorite teacher, because I never had to meet him, which is the rip in continuity, the perturbation. I've been looking, in German, it's Bruch, which is break. But break sounds so safe. Sounds like something, you know, take a break and then get back to work. And that's not what he means. But in pieces that he worked on, be they opera or be they plays with Kurt Weill or with Hans Eisler, the composer, Hans Eisler being perhaps the one you might look to in the Brechtian tradition, for the most access, he wrote a book with Theodor Adorno of the Frankfurt School about music for film that was a standard for quite some time and that spoke about counterpoints and creating a friction with the subject matter, about ways to do something else than use music to be an emotional assuaging.
That's really funny. So you mentioned Adorno, and it's really funny to me because I don't even think I've talked to you about this, but I've talked to you about the fact that I worked with the Rossini. So I worked on the Rossini Critical Edition with Baron Reiter, and so I spent a lot of time with Philip Gossett in actually like his last couple years of life, but he had a few Adorno texts, and it was definitely one of those things where Philip Gossett, obviously brilliant man, very traditionally minded, though, artistically. And like, they're obviously... He's, like, got a lot of thoughts on improvisation. I'm definitely not trying to paint with a wide brush here. But what I do think is interesting is, in European... in art, in the last century, there is a degree to which, at the time, a thing was deeply experimental. But that could then be brought into institution. And when that happens, it can become just part of that pedestal treatment of where it loses something. In your work, how have you thought about that? And what is there a degree to which you have found to keep the experimental, and how do you avoid that, like, institutionalization and putting up on a pedestal of something that, in its inception, was meant to be deeply experimental?
Well, one of the terms I use, which I borrow from my father, a new music composer, anti-communication, which is that moment when something is new, wants to be liked, but is not yet liked, and at a more basic level, doesn't communicate yet. When something completely communicates, we've consumed it, we know it. And one of the things I look for, because I think language is the system we all don't question, particularly those of us who haven't lived in more than one, we don't question language much. So one of the reasons I love opera, one of the reasons I love things that break the form, is anything that perturbs the natural seeming flow of language. But that extends to music too. As you say correctly, you can do a Puccini, so it just seems to flow inevitably the direction it should and doesn't need me a bit. And that's the essence. And that goes back to what I'm saying about needs to be live in a room. There is a kind of work. I'm a student of Heiner Müller, who I did meet and who was himself a student of Brecht's and who I worked with in East Germany when there was an East Germany. And his work was entirely to force an audience into making a greater effort, which sounds very severe in German, until you look at the people who are actually participating in that, which again, I had a privilege to do, and how involved and participatory and emotionally transporting that kind of fully paid attention without audience participation, as a safe audience allowed together with other audience to fully attend to some work that is requiring of you knowing you're there, knowing you're watching work, feeling needed in order to make the work go, it's something that is hardly available and of such great value that if you've lived through it somewhere, you're going to be reaching for that for the rest of your life, I think.
Mm-hmm. I'm interested in pivoting a little bit to talk about devising. Mm. I know that devising is a practice that is central to a lot of works that go up at the Prop Theater, specifically with Olivia Lilly, but also indeed, other productions that go up. I'm wondering if you could talk to us a little bit about your experience with it, kind of the benefits of it, you know, and also like why it is so often used in Chicago specifically.
Well, speaking a little historically, devising is one of those words that has come in, and I'm a language critic. The Adorno probably tips off in that direction. Mm-hmm. And look at it both critically and with a great deal of amusement. So when I came to Chicago, that term wasn't really available to me. What was a deep tension between the poles in music, composition, improvisation, and in theater, plays and improvisation. And what we noticed at the time is that the work that went into creating improvisation really interested us, captivated us. It's what the Compass Players did. Mm-hmm. And had something democratic, had something about bringing the world that was out around us into the rehearsal space every single day, had something about spontaneity and fluidity, about democracy and all of those things. And yet, when we went to the improv performance events, they seemed to have a whole lot to do with norming, with finding the lowest common denominator, being safe to laugh with everybody else laughing, with political correctness, and those type of things. So while we learned a lot from improvisation, we wanted to make something intentional and composed, but not composed by the individual at the desk. Learning from viewpoints and Bogart and that kind of work. And Carol Churchill, the playwright who never finished a play, and Brecht, without taking it first to a group of practitioners and working with it. The term composition always has this image of somebody sitting alone, perhaps a little tortured, perhaps with a crust of bread, at a desk with a little light, knowing better, which is a very patriarchal image. Mm-hmm. And devising offers us the stuff we learned from improv, the stuff we learned from democracy, the stuff we learned from feminism, the stuff we learned from sharing, the stuff we learned from being really skeptical of the genius with the entire plan in his head. And instead, to use composition strategies built on improvisation to make work that everyone really feels invested in. And the thing about Olivia that is so cool for me, I could have said all that before I met Olivia, and Olivia has renewed my practice. She has taken that so far further. And when I first watched her work, I immediately stole like 6 or 7 tactics from her rehearsings to bring to my actors who were like, oh, things like, instead of me saying lights when we start working on a scene, really little things like all the actors go around and say green light. And everybody is ready to start the rehearsed moment. It's a really dumb little thing, like for Brecht being able to show the stage lights. Things we take for granted now, we don't ascribe it to devising, we don't ascribe being able to see lights in a theater to Brecht, but they are the real innovations that make things possible and democratize the energy, and that's what I get from it.
Yeah, I'm so, I'm, you know, obviously not as familiar with, you know, the New York theater scene and the LA theater scene or the Omaha theater scene or whatever. But there is a lot of devising going on in Chicago. I wonder if does it have to do with the improv community, or does it just have to do with, you know, kind of like the, is it an extension of, you know, the realist theater movement? Or I'm wondering what role has this city played in the strength in with that devising has, like kind of the hold it has.
Others would probably be able to tell you better what the influence of New York upon that is. Specifically, right there, my experience is pretty thin. I know the experience from Berlin and from Europe a little bit more. What both bring is to a Chicago where a lot of the off-loop work was, let's be honest, let's be direct, let's be a little gritty, but very tending towards kitchen sink realism on the one hand, and sort of talking newspaper politics, very reacting to the moment on the other hand, or getting the laughs. And I think devising really opened up a world of for people who didn't want to necessarily use the term experimental, and I know my whole life from having a father in the experimental music movement, that one was always looking for a term that didn't say experimental, because the fact is most audiences are scared of the term experimental.
Right.
And Devised does cover experimental a little bit. It covers that you are no longer measured against a specific form, mm-hmm. and that alone is a freedom that opens up a tremendous amount of permission. And I feel prop theater has been a part of that in Chicago, just giving people permission when they come in, instead of fill out this form that tells me, you know, how are you going to do your 8 p.m. four times a week, you know, with curtain speech, and you're, you know, not defining the form they're going into, which I find in many of the theater listings here, you sort of have to be something you're not, yeah. as a Deviser in order to be able to fill your information into the listings, mm-hmm. and not doing that. Mm-hmm. And places like Trapdoor and Prop Theater and Tuta, not doing that has opened up a space. And now there's people doing things under Devising. If you go to the Constellation or the tradition of Lynx Hall,
yeah.
that goes back in history to Mo Ming and Bob Eisen, who came before us, and they just celebrated, I don't know how many years of Lynx Hall, but it's a lot.
I think they just hit 40.
40 years yeah. of Lynx Hall, which is we're close to, but that's where I went when I first came, was not just to the theaters, but to Mo Ming, which is a forerunner of Lynx Hall, where Bob Eisen was dancing and where experimental work was being done and new music and pocket opera and mm-hmm. those kind of things.
I want to touch more on, you know, one of the things that you brought up before was the interesting space that we were in during the Harold Washington years. And I do think that the idea of local politics and how it relates to art is really fascinating because it can be so influential. And so I'm curious for you, I mean, do you think that we're in a time that that is similar to that era? And what do you think art making in Chicago has to gain from any political moment that we're in right now?
I do think we're in a similar time. You just kind of made me think of it, to be perfectly honest with you. I guess it's been slowly coming into my brain before. Of course, there's differences, but when we started, it was Reagan era.
Right.
And then there came Harold Washington. Where are we now? Look at who is in the federal government and look at what we have coming in the city of Chicago. I would say it's safe to say, with all preferences aside, we're going to have something that perturbs business as usual. And that, above all, is what Harold Washington is, perturbed business as usual. He brought some color into the mayor's office also, which scared the hell out of them then, and unfortunately will probably still scare the hell out of most regular administration in Chicago. But things have changed since 1983. They've changed a lot. Chicago has a chance to be in the leadership. There is something good about both candidates who are running, something very good even compared to who we have now as mayor. And mm-hmm. that gives me a lot of optimism that Chicago has a chance to show not going along with the federal trend, has a chance to show an urban landscape that distinguishes itself.
Mm-hmm. So I want to dive a little bit more deeply into Brecht, because I know that he very, you know, he deeply influences the prop theater. I know that I'm wondering, what about his impact on the theater community and theatrical literature? What about that impact has inspired you through your artistic career?
Waking up. Brecht for me, really, in this time, if I try to speak about it, and you hear people who have faced peril and want to tell others about it, and tell others that, hey, you may not know about this peril because of your privilege. What above all you have to do is be woke. You can't be woke. You have to wake up. The unpleasant way to wake up is to actually face peril or face poverty your whole life. The other way, which isn't the same, but goes near there and is what Brecht or Augusto Boal, after him, were about, is how to intervene in the flow of events. How to not just stand back and observe them, be a spectator, but in Boal's words, be a spectactor, how to interrupt, and this is where Brecht really comes in, work that interrupts itself, that interrupts all suggestions of a natural flow, of a spiritual flow, of anything that happens without you. Brecht was a humanist in the sense alone that he thought human beings were at the center of consideration. And I share that with him, that the human being and human beings, pluralistically, are at the center of considerations. And much of the things that lull us to sleep are abstractions that have nothing to do with human beings mm-hmm. being at the center of events, whether it's a sturdy economy, whether it's beauty, whether it's culinary preparations. They don't really have the human being at their center, and those need to be interrupted, according to Brecht, by human considerations. And Aaron Freeman, who is both a comedian who longstanding in Chicago and a science journalist who does science programming. He's the chairman of our board at the Prop Theater and a long years friend and a teacher who I admire much. And his line is, the human being is always the problem. You know, people are banging at their computers and go, this darn thing and so forth. And he goes, no. It's the human being. It's always the human being who's the problem. And that's not because he's a misanthrope. I'm more of a misanthrope than he is. He's really a very nice guy. But that we identify the problem needs to be loved more, and the efficiency needs to be loved less. The flow needs to be loved less. And the interruption, that's Brecht. That's alienation technique, interrupting the flow and making the person indispensable to the moment at hand.
I'm curious what your view is of how technology has influenced art making, because a lot of what we focus on is like how to make things more accessible, how more people can click of a button and experience art. I'm curious, based on your affinity toward that kind of human-centered, people first mentality, I'm curious what your thoughts on being able to click a link and be at the theater is.
Well, Brecht was at the dawn of radio, and that was hugely important to him. And I do think that Chicago theater, as I arrived upon the scene, its wish to portray and to create an illusion matched it to movies that were growing and CGI was just beginning and so forth. Things have changed. Mm-hmm. And now technology is so able to bring us into a convincing illusion that it no longer is that interesting for theater to do so. Mm-hmm. Working over in Europe, I got to work at some of the hugest budget theaters where they were really working three-story sets for Harry Ape and whatnot to create the illusion. And one of the reasons I came back here was realizing that's not what I'm looking for anymore. I do believe that technology has both created the ability to absolutely make no difference between illusion and reality if it's being mediated. Hence, the live event has got a need now that it never had before, because we used to believe photos. We used to believe what we saw on screen. Mm-hmm. And maybe we shouldn't have then, but we certainly shouldn't now. Mm-hmm. And if you're there live and in the moment, that is something indispensable. And I believe it's why audiences are growing. At a certain point, there is a loneliness to being in a huge social media group on a phone.
So do you think that as technology, do you think that as technology kind of moves to the forefront of people's minds and, as communities are being built, like in the palm of your hand, do you think that that trend will continue of live performance being of more importance? Or do you think that genuinely curious. This is not coming from any, but so do you think that those audiences will continue to grow, or do you think that eventually technology will kind of,
stifle it?
Yeah.
I don't think live performance is more important. To me, it's more important because it's what I do. I don't think it's more important. And I do think there's something dialectical to your question already in how you ask it correctly, mm-hmm. which is that in working with each other, if they are responding to each other, and particularly live performance responding to the progresses in technology, mm-hmm. both by being there for the exhaustion with it and not trying to imitate
right,
it,
yeah.
but provide an alternative to it. Mm-hmm. And that's really the core of what prop theater does. But also, audiences are a whole lot smarter because of all this technology. They have access to information in ways and many different types of information, but also atomized references like never before. We can't count on people all knowing the same story they heard yesterday. So the challenges and the opportunities are different due to the technology. And I do think it's a cross working. But I do think that they've been saying that live theater's over since before
yeah.
this time reckoning. As long as there are texts, both language has been dying, and we're going to be grunting like cavemen in a couple of years. There's actually a text like that in BC something, and theater's going to die, and it hasn't happened yet.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I think it's really interesting, the piece that the idea of that human instinct of working against flow is very interesting to me, especially like I think about it a lot with podcasting. Obviously we have a podcast, and with technology more and more what we're seeing is studios and radio stations kind of taking up podcasting. And where I'm going with this is that the thing that is interesting that is
Let me jump in on a little bit, because that made me think of something right then and there, which is the same thing I said about now the institutions are slowly picking up the experiment.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And what is then necessary for us to do, if we don't frankly want to be economically drowned by that, is to renew the experiment. Mm-hmm. Don't get comfortable. My grandfather, who was a very successful actor, speaks of the decisive moment in his career, the director Erich Engel, who was central to developing the Brechtian form, as were that whole community of co-workers who worked around Brecht. And my grandfather, who was part of that group too, was a successful actor doing expressionist theater on the big stages in Berlin and playing Othello and whatnot. And Erich Engel went to him and said, yeah, you're echoing your big successes wonderfully. You are imitating yourself successfully. You're doing what you have learned works, and you're stuck in it. And a lot of us who were the devisers, we're the experimenters, we go there. We get something good. And because economics are hard and holding the attention of audiences is very difficult, and in New York, it's much worse, this much I know of it, you do something good and you better do that exact same show in one name or another in that $1 million location mm-hmm. for the rest of your life. So experimenting, particularly when you've had a success or when the institutions start to take you up, mm-hmm. becomes particularly difficult.
Well, and another thing that I realized I was going with was the thought of what technology has done to me in my limited experience with the bridge between technology and art, is that it's made it feel like that flow of making things very accessible. I mean, accessibility, of course, is very important. But what I mean is it being clean, not messy, very institutional. Like, you pick up a live stream, and if it doesn't have an intro or you know, high quality video footage, like, if you can't tell that there's been a lot of production and money put into it, like, there's a degree to which technology rewards that. And the audience on technology rewards that. But I think it's really interesting to think about the idea that someone like Brecht was very drawn to radio, and the idea also that radio predated, like, there was a degree to, and maybe this is an assumption of mine because I wasn't there when radio was happening, but there's a degree to which I think it was inherently messier because those institutions around it didn't exist yet. But now that we're living in a world where those institutions exist, like, the spaces like podcasting has been around for 10 years,
maybe 15.
And it's like, we have clean podcasting, like, really, like, you know, institutional podcasting in a way that's thriving in the last 5 years.
It's changing. If you look at some podcasts and some vlogs mm-hmm. that are on there, particularly among Generation Z, really young ones, mm-hmm. there's something that I would call glitch culture. Which is, and if you look at even, it's already been institutionalized. If you look at major television broadcasting of sort of reality TV, their edits start to look like, oh, the TV's going fuzzy. Wait a minute. Oh, the TV's breaking up. Yeah. And they actually do that on purpose as an attraction to make it seem more authentic, more real, less contrived. Mm-hmm. And now something like that is very hard to stay ahead of it becoming culinary. But I do think that in a time where a whole generation imagines itself heading towards an Anthropocene, where indeed human beings are responsible for and are damaging the entire structure we live in, that people are starting to think of nature as a glitch, as a damage, rather than as a clean, aesthetically perfect whole. And I think aesthetics are breaking down.
Mm. Yeah, the comment about beauty getting in the way of
human beings.
Of human beings is certainly telling, because I mean, as you know, as an artist, where like I'll just speak to my experience as a plus size opera singer. I'm a soprano and my voice is lighter. And I think that it's harder for me to get cast in roles that are appropriate for my voice because the aesthetics
of
get
a soubrette is a
exactly
because yeah. I'm an ingenue. Yeah.
Exactly right. So I'm supposed to be an ingenue, and I don't look like an ingenue.
To them.
And so, to them, exactly. I think I look like an ingenue. But I think that you're absolutely right, that certain aesthetics and certain aesthetic goals and certain, you know, ideals of beauty are getting in the way of talent and identifying who will portray this character more authentically. That's not to say that, you know, conventionally attractive ingenues are shitty, but
no, but there is what funnily enough happens, and I see it happening around Olivia's work, is that when you change the criteria for casting, yes, the old casting, if you grew up in this society, were trained by expectations of film and television and the theater as it was functioning, came up through it and saw it cast as it was conventionally cast, that had a satisfaction abstractly to it. If mm-hmm. you weren't one of the excluded peoples,
right.
It had a satisfaction to it. But likewise, now you see someone challenging, be that glitch culture or whatever, challenging those expectations, finding another criteria. Who's the best actor for this role? Who can bring the emotionally most surprising moments in? Who can shock us out of our boredom with this kind of work? That can create a beauty also, because we create beauty live and in the room. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to conform to laws of what beauty was.
Well, and also we're talking about it being experimental and shocking, but it's also at the same time much more real, you know, because it's not, the world isn't just full of beautiful people experiencing things. It's full of every type of person experiencing things, but we don't see every type of person being portrayed experiencing.
We're not given permission mm-hmm. to see the beauty in human beings, because we are too caught up with the beauty of abstractions and ideals.
Exactly. No, I know not much about Brecht, but I think that that's fascinating. Like, that's
Brecht was a poet above all. He was a poet yeah. first and foremost. That's where he started, a singer. And he considered poetry an extension of singing, but his poetry went way beyond accompaniment to music. And his poetry went back behind the Romantic period and behind Goethe, that was leading Goethe to Americans, that was leading much of German culture. Back to the Luther Bible he went, actually. And if you look at the Book of Job in the German, and the Luther Bible is a little bit like Shakespeare. But what he was about, and this refers to what you were saying, was coming back to the truth about human life, not romanticized life, not a heroic life, not abstract life. As a doctor working in the area of Munich at the edge of World War I, the one thing he really grew to hate from experience were heroic talk while poor people were being slaughtered and shot left and right, and seeing that. And I do believe that those are things that marked him deeply. And his poetry is full of the dirt and beauty of organic being.
That's fascinating.
Oh, I forgot already. keeps happening. You're too thoughtful. Thank you. You're too thought invoking. Like, I'm like, I keep jumping from thought to thought.
Well, so while you're thinking, so what, like, so the Prop Theater has been around for 31 years, you said?
We've been around since 1981. I am really, really, really bad at math, but I think that's more like 36 or 37.
Yeah, I think you're right. but I'm curious, like, you know, y'all have been around for such a long time. Where do you see yourself, like, where do you see Prop Theater going, like, in the next 5 or 10 years?
Well, I want to say something. First of all, where we came from, and then to that real quick. One of the things that was really important where we came from, and he's not able to represent, he has Parkinson's now, is not so active on the scene, but the co-founder and the older of the two of us, also inexperienced, was Scott Vigil, who did not start with Brecht. He did act in my first Brecht and was wonderful. He came from a tradition of the Beats, which is also very influential. Olivia Lilly is extremely influenced by the Beats and Kerouac and so forth. And we did William Burroughs' work. William Burroughs came to visit us.
Really?
And that, yeah, he came to visit us. Cool. We did a piece of his. Terry Southern, we've worked with. There's a long, strong tradition, playwrights like Charles Pike and Paul Pedido, working with work that relates back to an American tradition of telling your own story. We have a tradition of Chicago stories. Paul Carr's about the Harold Washington campaign, Busted City, that we performed in our theater, that we performed in a neighborhood bar and got people from the South Side to cross the city to come see it, and that we made into a film. So I do think there's a future in telling stories that are immediate to people. You don't have to do gritty realism to tell stories that are immediate to people. I think the way to tell stories that are immediate to people is really changing, but I do think that Olivia's got her finger right on it, and above all is opening it up to all sorts of people who are bringing really new, surprising ways to be very immediate to what's going on around us in our community, in the stories we have to tell.
That's a perfect segue into remembering what I was going to ask. And I don't mean for this interview entirely to be brought to you by Olivia Lilly, but one of the things that she said on the last time that we had on is something that people keep saying to me, like, I love the way that she worded that, which is the idea that Chicago is very much a working class artist city. And I think that is something, I mean, maybe this is an assumption, I think this is something that's something that is very true to prop theaters, the way it works. And I'm curious for you, what does that mean to you, and how does that affect in your work?
Again, I can go back and then forward real quick. Back, a really decisive moment for the Prop Theater, and I was in Germany, I have very little to do with it, was Paul Pedido's adaptation produced by Scott Vigil and directed by Jennifer Markowitz, an amazing director, perhaps one of the strongest directors we've ever had working at the Prop Theater in our history before Olivia, did Never Come Morning by Nelson Algren. Nelson Algren was really important, not just to Chicago, but to the neighborhood in which the Prop Theater was at the time, and Nelson Algren was a writer who was so in fashion when there was one wave of fashion and then was so out of fashion in the next one. He was someone who wanted to talk about real life. And an old, out-of-date prop theater motto is, prop theater tells stories about real life, and real life ain't always pretty. And that's a that's an ethos that I think that we kept and going into a new time. The point is that in a time when, instead of fighting against censorship, which was some of a lot of the traditions we came out of, where it was bringing things out into the open that were concealed, that weren't allowed to be talked about, we live in an opposite time now. We live in a time now where everybody gets to say everything, and the same problem is a result of the deluge that was the problem of the forbidding. So today we need to, instead of opening up and championing only free speech or the different, we need to select amongst the deluge. We need to find ways also to protect for self-care in the deluge of information. It's not enough to be libertaire and free speech in a time when everybody's being cudgeled by the amount of data, information, stimulation, and impulses. We need to change what we do to help with that.
Yeah.
Well,
You're just very thoughtful.
Yeah, not like...
I'm old. I've been doing this for a while. Yeah. I'm 59 years old. And I've been doing this for a long time, and I've really been privileged that in two different languages, in two different places, not only the old teachers who I didn't have to meet, but the younger teachers who I'm still meeting. Mm-hmm. I've been really lucky about the people who will take a little bit of time. And I learned from the composer Pauline Oliveros, the idea of close listening. And she's the originator of that. Mm-hmm. And it's something that I think is the core of what I bring to my work. I've never been the kind of brilliant maker that I think Jenny Magnusson, Bo O'Reilly of the Curious Theater branch are. Olivia, as a writer, creator, maker, deviser, is. I'm much more of an organizer of what comes in to me and an attender. I pay very close attention and have learned to pay close attention without suffering it so much that it ends up being self-damaging. And that's what I bring.
That is deeply identifiable to me, or I see myself in that very deeply, because, like, you know, we've built this infrastructure, we've built Skapi, but it is an infrastructure that is entirely based on the idea of amplifying other people's brilliant work. And there has been a fair amount of, like, ingenuity and, like, figuring out our own things so that we are the most effective platform for that possible. But, like, it is wild to see and to conceive of and think about the amazing work that we get to talk to people about. Mm-hmm. And so, like, being an organizer and being a facilitator and being, you know, observing and listening is, like, something that rings very true to what we're trying to do as well.
I've had a lot of conversations in the last couple weeks, actually, with people that are in this weird position where they trained as a performer, but they find themselves with responsibilities of that of an administrative. And there's the degree to which it's difficult when you find yourself in that position to not feel jealous or, you know, FOMO. And the thing that I know that I've kind of, that has dawned on me over the last year is that, maybe two, is that, like, if I'm weighing the two identities of what I could be doing, the idea of being a performer, like, of an opera performer, the what was available to me to do that was very traditional, extremely so, like doing the young artist program route, doing that entire or what Skapi has turned into. And when it's that dialectic, it's like fuck, like, I don't know, like, why would I ever do
mm-hmm. Has a lot to do with why I decided to come back from Germany and the institution, mm-hmm. where I very specifically could do the work with all the facilities I wanted, but it was in an institution with tremendous bureaucracy and inertia and holding on to old values that I found offensive, and employment relations that I found, mm-hmm. although well-paying, offensive. And it became more important to me to be able to own what I do. And I notice when I direct, I'd rather that an actor on stage owns what they're doing up there, and this goes to devising, mm-hmm. than does what I think. I'd rather be surprised. And often I've learned enough to know, even when it annoys me what they're doing, that I sometimes, three performances from now, will actually learn something, mm-hmm. if I let those things happen. And likewise, in a conversation like this, I grow smarter than I am in other circumstances. It is so much a matter of the very ephemeral presence in the moment one happens to be in. And mm-hmm. for me, I've felt that so much in my life, that I can be smart and full of ideas in one moment when a good conversation stimulates that, and I can be the last fool on the block, mm-hmm. when it's not there.
Cool. Well, I think we definitely have a few minutes left. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for coming on.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Yeah, we would love to. We always say this, but it's especially true that we always love having people back on. And I'm sure our audience would agree that we'd love to talk to you more as things maybe leading up to. I don't know. I mean, so many things, especially, like, I could definitely just sit and have a conversation with you about Rhino Fest alone.
Yeah,
would be awesome. Yeah. So many things that the prop theater is doing. But anyway, the last thing we do with all of our guests is a 1-minute plug for anything that you have upcoming. Sometimes it's very obvious, like letting people know where they can find out about all the works that are going on at the prop, if that were a thing. otherwise, we love hearing shout outs to other folks that are doing dope work, or any media that you're consuming, personal, otherwise, so self-care or otherwise, music, movies, TV shows, things like that.
Well, okay, that's a wonderful invitation, only slightly daunting because of my relative incapacity to remember correct names of things and so forth, so I'm going to do my best, and the main thing I have to plug is this creation since 1981 of the Prop Theater, which Scott Vigil and I had the privilege to found and to allow to change enough, and Olivia Lilly, who has taken it over, refreshed it, made it new, given it a strength it never had before, and all the things that we aimed for refreshed that kind of aim, and that it's a place where you can come and you can both attend experiments of all sorts, theatrical, musical, operatic, movement-based. You can also bring work, and you don't have to come with the traditional selling it. You don't have to pitch it. You don't have to tell me why this will make it in the business world. Neither Olivia on the production end nor me on the venue management end have that as our criteria. We're both interested in what you really want, why this is adding something to the world right now, whether people want it yet or not. And for my side of it, as a venue, we have all sorts of different arrangements. We don't try to fit you into our standard. We don't have an hourly rate. We have everything from people coming in for a meeting where they need one music stand and some chairs around, to people wanting to build a three-story structure and run a five-hour show for 7 weeks. You can't have one rate for that. But what you can have is a very flexible ear, an attention to what people are telling you. And I love to invite people over, show them around a two-theater space venue with an art gallery in the middle being run by Nina D'Angier, who is just a wonderful designer with immersive spaces, and an upstairs costume shop and dressing rooms and offices and a little Brecht library. I like to invite people to come over, get a tour, and then tell me what they're working on and how maybe there could be a fit of bringing something in here, and we like to give permission to do it.
Cool.
Hell yeah.
Well, thank you all so much for listening. I've been Dan Johansson.
I continue to be Maureen Smith.
If you want to keep up with what we are up to, there are so many ways you can do that. The first is to head over to scopymag.com. That's our website. We post all of our articles there, as well as all of our podcast episodes. You can also keep up with us on social media. On Facebook, we have a Facebook page called Scopy Magazine. We also have a Facebook group that we love and adore called Sounding Board, where we talk about local arts, local politics, and astrology memes. Otherwise, you can find us on Instagram, Twitter, and Tumblr under Scopy Mag, spelled the same way, S-C-A-P-I-M-A-G. And you can find the podcast, the one you're listening to right now, under Scopy Radio and most podcast places, including Google Play, iTunes Podcasts, and Radio Public.
And I'm here, as always, to talk about the importance of subscribing. If you head to our website, scopymag.com, and go to our subscribe page, there are a couple ways that you can do that. The first is to sign up for email blasts. This is huge because even though we post across social media platforms, Facebook buries our content. So if you want to see 100% of what we're doing and not just 30% of it, you should sign up for those email blasts. The second thing you can do is become a member. For as little as $2 a month, you can help us keep our lights on and pay our artists. We're in the middle of a fundraising campaign right now called the Sustain Campaign, where at one point our lowest membership level was $5. We've lowered that to $2 because we believe that not everybody has $5 a month to spare, but we think that most people have $2. So if you're in a position to do that, it would mean the world to us. Head to scopymag.com/subscribe and become part of the family. Also, we have merch for sale. If you head to scopymag.com/store, you can buy your new favorite t-shirt, and that is a promise. And lastly, if you are a business or an entity or just have something fun to say and want to advertise with us, please feel free to reach out to us at scopymag@gmail.com. So give a little, give a lot, and if you can't give, then listen, participate, and share.
Cool. Thanks again so much for listening. Go out and make something.
Yep.